Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent and affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, the Roundtable is privileged to present a special program from the Second International Symposium on Feelings and Emotions, which is meeting on the campus of the University of Chicago, and which is co-sponsored by the Loyal Order of Moose and the University of Chicago. The Roundtable subject, Emotions and World Problems. This is the problem. What practical effectiveness can this research have in delivering mankind from the menace of war? What can the latest scientific research on emotional problems and feelings contribute to our understanding of war? The printed pamphlet of today's discussion of emotions and world problems will include the notable exchange of letters between Professor Albert Einstein and Sigmund Freud on Why War? Send 10 cents to the University of Chicago Roundtable for your copy of this pamphlet, including the letters of Professor Einstein and Freud. To introduce today's roundtable discussion, we present James G. Miller, Chairman of the Department of Psychology of the University of Chicago. Dr. Miller.
Today's roundtable participants are members of an international group representing world thought on recent advances in understanding human feelings and emotions. There has been rapid advance in the sciences of man, the psychological and sociological sciences. Many people have the impression that the imponderable and unsubstantial matters like the mind and human feelings cannot be dealt with scientifically. But we believe it is important to investigate human emotions as precisely and impartially as any other problem of science. During the last few days in our International Symposium on Feelings and Emotions at Moose Heart and on the campus of the University of Chicago, over 2,000 scientists from a dozen countries have discussed the many new advances in such research. Scientists from four countries, representing different traditions, speaking with different accents, and yet trying in common to understand these common problems which have such vital concern for all of us in the present grave world situation, join us in today's roundtable. I should like to ask you, the listener, to try to understand the natural divergences of attitudes of our speakers and to comprehend nevertheless, despite this, how they all and all of us can work dispassionately in world unity on such issues. Joining me in this roundtable discussion of emotions and world problems are Dr. Lambert van der Horst, child psychiatrist of Amsterdam, Holland, Professor Robert H. Thawless, psychologist in the Department of Education, Cambridge University, England, Dr. Joseph Nutin, psychologist and priest of the University of Louvain, Belgium, and Professor Gardner Murphy, psychologist of City College of New York and former president of the American Psychological Association. Professor Tholis, what is your view of the importance of the study of emotional patterns as a contribution to international relations and the problem of war?
Well, I'd like to talk about the part that language plays in creating feelings of hostility between nations. The effect of language on people's thinking is a question I've been interested in for some years. I've written some books about it, and I've just read a paper about it to our symposium on feelings and emotions.
Yes, and Father Nutin, how do you view the problem of solving tensions among nations?
Well, the general attitude in Europe at the present time is one of great skepticism about the effectiveness of psychological studies in solving political problems. It's the political attitudes of the leaders, often relatively few leaders, that matter. The common attitude is that these are political and not scientific problems.
And what is your personal point of view on this?
Well, I have done some research on emotional attitudes and hostility feelings. And I should like to stress that we have to consider chiefly the intellectual or rational basis which gives rise to such feelings. What one nation knows or thinks it knows about another is an important source of emotional attitudes. And therefore, I think that the major factor in improving our emotional attitudes will be the improvement of our knowledge about each other.
Dr. Vanderhorst, you're one of the outstanding child psychiatrists of Holland. What is your area of particular concern in the matter of understanding world tensions?
I was always interested in the analysis of the individual feelings and in the way specific elements can build up complicated human emotions as hate and hostility.
And Professor Murphy, what is your particular interest in this problem?
In our laboratory at City College, New York, we have been studying for some years specific ways in which emotion and personal needs can influence perception, learning, memory, and thinking.
Professor Tholis, I'd like to have some more of your point of view on this matter of the control of emotions, in particular the relationship of emotion to language.
Well, I'm not inclined to think that a very important factor in driving nations to war is what people call human aggressiveness. It isn't the case that men want to go to war. They go out to wars unwillingly to defend their country when wars break out. When wars break out for such reasons, for example, as the conflicts of national interests, which haven't very much to do with psychology. Wars don't break out because men have a feeling of aggressiveness that drives them to fight.
Well, if not, why do you think they do?
Why wars do break out? Well, I think, as I say, such things as conflicts of national interests. But men get no real satisfaction to their aggressiveness out of modern war.
Why don't they?
Well, the conditions of war have changed. You probably, if you felt aggressive, got some kick out of hitting your enemy over the head with a battle axe. But you don't get any satisfaction out of the elaborate manipulation of a gun or a semi-automatic plotting machine, which is what you have to do nowadays. But where psychology does enter in is in the creation of all those irrational forces that lead men to look at the enemy as somebody altogether hateful and their own cause as something altogether just. And one way of making people irrational is the emotional use of language. That is, using words to call up feelings instead of to convey information.
Can you give any illustration of how that happened?
Well, we can take an example of a speech, very good speech, made by one of the leaders during the last war. It ran like this. Hitler and his Nazi gang have sown the wind. Let them reap the whirlwind. Neither the length of the struggle nor any form of severity which it may assume will make us weary or will make us quit. These gangs of bandits have sought to darken the light of the world, have sought to stand between the common people of all the lands and their march forward to their inheritance. Well, that's the kind of thing I mean by the emotional use of language. It isn't conveying any information. It's just calling up strong feelings. And I have no quarrel with it there. It happened during a war. If you have wars at all, you have to stir up people's feelings. And the use of emotional language is a way to do it. Makes men efficient soldiers. It doesn't make them think sensibly. The real danger is going on using such language in peacetime to stir up hostile feelings against other nations. As soon as we start thinking of or talking about any other national group as gangs of bandits or some such way, we've taken a step towards war.
How are we going to be able to keep from this?
Well, I'm not against the idea of reducing people's aggressiveness as much as the psychotherapists such as Professor Vanderhorst can do it. But I think we also have to take steps to abolish people's tendency to become irrational under the influence of emotional language. As to how? By education. That's by teaching people, when they hear emotional oratory that carries them away, to put into their own minds neutral words which don't carry strong feelings, and then they can see exactly how much real sense there is in the oratory which has moved them so much.
Yes, indeed, Professor Tholis. And now I'm going to turn to Father Nutin. Professor Nutin, as professor of social psychology, you have investigated the attitudes of Europeans toward each other. What matters would you stress particularly in this area?
I can best give you, I think, an example of what I mean. In my country, indeed, I made an investigation about the emotional attitudes of high school boys towards the Dutch people. and I found that a lot of these boys manifested feelings of contempt and hostility towards our neighbors. Continuing this investigation, I was surprised to see that several boys gave up mainly historical reasons to motivate their hostility feelings. It was because 100 years ago, the neighbor people tried to dominate our country that the boys did not like them. And on this basis, all kind of unfriendly traits of character were attributed to them. I talked about this question with the teacher. And now I found that the course in history given to the boys ended with a vivid description of the revolution of our people against the neighbor people 100 years ago. But about the friendly relationships between the two peoples in the more recent years, nothing was taught.
Why was that?
Well, I think that it is not very reasonable to feel contempt or hostility against other people for historical reasons. And this is an example of emotional attitudes which can be improved by improving educational methods in providing knowledge and information. And I do not mean at all that historical truth must be blurred, but historical...
Not blurred.
But historical truth must be taught in constructive ways. And therefore, friendly and cultural relationships, which make peoples growing closer together, must be stressed rather than omitted.
And you think that if these friendly relationships are stressed, that the emotions of the people will be more properly directed toward world peace?
I think so. And it is not only the case for high school boys, but also for adults. And perhaps I should like to add that the same thing can be said about the daily course in history, which is given by our newspapers.
Thank you. And now I'm going to turn to Dr. Vanderhorst. A moment or two ago, Professor Tholis mentioned psychotherapists and their attitudes toward aggression. Now tell me, Dr. Vanderhorst, what is known about the psychology of hate and hostility?
Hate and hostility belong to the complicated feelings in which different elements work together. And one of the most fundamental factors is what Dr. Tholis mentioned, the aggressive attitude.
If our frustration does intensify the aggressive attitude, Dr. Vanderhorst, does it always beget hostility?
Not necessarily. Feelings like hate and hostility appear when we add the human element.
The human element.
If you should like to know what I mean, then I mention the words of Nietzsche. We make war because we are murderers in our inner selves. There is in each human being an inborn disposition to tragedy, to pain and evil, to disrespect, to devalue others. In union with the aggressive drive, this may lead to war and destruction. So the big question is if there is a very strong aggressive drive or not.
In other words, I gather that you think aggression is valuable to an extent, but if it goes too far, it is dangerous.
Then it is dangerous. Our judgment of this drive depends upon different circumstances.
Well, tell me, Dr. Vanderhorst, how do emotions becloud rational processes?
In violent emotions, there are two possibilities. Two possibilities in behavior, as we can see it in animals. First, a total paralysis. The second possibility is a lot of desperate movements. The same holds for rational processes. Whether rational behavior is blocked or whether thoughts are crowded without any dominant idea.
What suggestions do you have, Dr. Vanderhorst, as to methods which might be used to control hostility?
If we are to prevent war and hostility, we have first to discover how far our own lives are motivated by violent aggressive drives. And secondly, we must be aware of the human tendency to disrespect and to devalue other human beings. The aggressive drive is intensified by frustration. For example, the frustrated child tries to reestablish his lost balance. In his effort to satisfy his drives, he forms bad habits, which in the end will bring him to an unsocial life.
Then you think that something can be done to prevent frustration and so prevent aggression?
Yes, we need to prevent frequent frustration and to teach the child to value each human being. In this way, perhaps hostility and war can belong to the past.
Thank you, Dr. Van der Horst. And now, Professor Murphy, we've heard from an Englishman, a Belgian, and a Dutchman. What do you, as an American scientist, have to say about these questions?
Well, going back to Father Nutin's comment about European skepticism as to what can be done by psychological research in relation to politics, I think it would be fair to say that progress in such matters inevitably comes very slowly. Yet American politics has actually been influenced somewhat by the studies of political scientists. And our own war effort was influenced by public opinion studies and by studies of leadership. Even if our contribution is small now, I'd say let's do what we can and hope that as the years roll on, they will make a huge difference.
Yes. Well, now we have had various points of view suggested and various types of research mentioned for investigating these problems. We've had a discussion of the relation between emotions and language. We've had a discussion about how people can be educated to interpret their own history and to view it in terms of factual knowledge rather than in terms of emotion. Dr. Van der Horst has mentioned the role of rearing of children and aggression in the question of prevention of aggressive attitudes in adults. And Professor Murphy has referred to various researches that are being done in America in the question of relations between people. Now, we have all this knowledge and a great deal more which has been discussed in these days of our symposium here. Why is it, and I want to address this to all of you gentlemen, why is it that we have not been able to make practical application of these bits of knowledge that we have at the present time? Why is it that we not yet do have the promise of world peace? And what do you think can be done practically to bring it about?
Well, I should like to give an answer to your question. I think that most of the researches done in this field are still in an experimental stage. The results obtained are still incomplete and do not yet present concrete solutions of the complex problems we find in international life, I think.
And Dr. Van der Horst, do you have any comments on this?
Yes. I agree with Dr. Nutin. We have to do with very complicated feelings, and we start to analyze the feelings. But we always have to take in our account that if, for instance, we are speaking about aggression, we need a certain amount of aggression. So it is always difficult to have the practice consequence of it.
What would you have to say about this, Professor Murphy, about this general issue that we're discussing now? Is what can be done practically to make this science effective?
It seems to me that we put a premium on emotional fireworks in our discussion of international affairs, and often, instead of lacking information, fail to apply what is evident on the basis of research. A man can have a strong determination to defend what he believes and yet keep his head at the same time. But our social habit, for example, in political life, is to cut loose with invective and emotional orgies of name-calling. Just as happens between two men, each party to the dispute inflames the other.
Professor Tholis, do you have anything to add?
Yes, well, it seems to me there's a great flood of unreasonableness. The forces opposed to it sometimes seem to be weak, but I think it all really starts in school. We can teach children to talk sensibly and not emotionally about other people, to take other people's point of view, and generally to make good world citizens. And I think what we have to remember in school and elsewhere is that war is not the only problem. The problem is all these irrational hate attitudes towards other human groups. That's between white and colored people, between Anglo-Saxons and South Europeans, and between Gentiles and Jews. And our aim isn't merely to avoid wars, it's to establish the brotherhood of all men.
You're speaking about these irrational attitudes between various nations. Father Nitin, I remember that some years ago, the relations between Belgium and Holland were more strained than they are at the present time. What has been done to improve this situation?
Well, I think that the fact that since the war, a lot of university professors were visiting our country and that our university professors were visiting Holland, that so by improving our mutual knowledge in Belgium about Holland and in Holland about Belgium, that was one of the important factors in improving the good relations about the two peoples.
Well, Dr. van der Horst, you're a Dutchman. Now, you have been on the other side of it.
Yes. I agree with Dr. Nutan. Before the last World War, we didn't know much from the people in Belgium. And now, after the war, the universities of Belgium came with help to us, and we came in touch with
you
the
gave
people.
Mutual assistance each to the other.
Yes, mm-hmm. And now there is also more appreciation. Mm-hmm. We know each other, and we know the ideas and also the difficulties we had before the war.
Well, that exactly was what I mean, that better information, better knowledge can improve our emotional attitudes toward each other.
And now I understand that it's possible for the University of Louvain, your university, Dr. Nutin, to give an honorary degree to the Queen of Holland, something which wouldn't have been possible perhaps a few years ago.
That's right.
And we were very glad that it was possible, for before the war, we had no contact with the University of Louvain. We came from time to time to Brussels, but we went to Paris. We went to Geneva. We never came to Louvain. After the war, it was the University of Louvain who came first to Amsterdam. And so we get in touch with the University of Louvain, and we could appreciate it.
We had a very interesting illustration in this symposium of how emotions becloud even the thinking of scientists. We made every effort we could to have a Russian scientist come to discuss the matter of emotions, and yet it was impossible to get a representative from the Soviet. However, we did find that the attitude of the Soviet toward the question of scientific investigation of the emotions is very different from the attitude of Americans and Europeans generally. Because there, in Russia, they feel that the political point of view of the scientists, their own value systems, affect the scientific investigations, and it is impossible to be objective about these matters. Therefore, they say that unless you have the same sort of philosophical background as they have in Russia, and we do not in capitalist countries, it would be impossible for us to communicate on these matters. Do you think that that's true, Professor Murphy?
I don't think we have a broad enough factual basis of understanding Russian cultural conditions to judge that immediately. But I would like to suggest the things that, from our side, I think we can do. There are at least six of them. First, we can get our information from many sources.
And by us, you mean every lay citizen?
I mean absolutely everybody. And test that material for objectivity. Second, one can make a habit of reading biography, history, or fiction about people who seem strange to us until we learn to see what the world looks like through their eyes. Third, we can try our hands at predicting, month by month, what we think will happen in international relations, recording the predictions, and ruthlessly checking up on our errors, gradually learning by tough experience where our biases are crippling our judgment.
What other methods can be used?
Well, I think that as you follow a controversy in the press or over the air, you can identify yourself by turns with each contestant, instead of taking sides at the beginning. That is, without giving up your own values and ideals. You can learn to see by turns how it looks to each person. Fifth, you can take time to study the historical and cultural background from which each phase of international relations follows. So, instead of a sense of arbitrariness, you will see the logic of events. For example, you will see the forces that push Vyshinsky or Molotov and are perhaps less likely to be content with the cliché that the man is simply obstinate. Along these lines, I would emphasize especially the objective studies of national character that are now being made at the great university centers, not in terms of good and bad, but in terms of cultural diversities. And finally, it seems to me that the light must be thrown upon ourselves with exactly the same objectivity. Our own American national culture and character must be studied objectively by scholars both from our own and from other lands, so that ultimately there will be an international science, and human relations will be one of the subject matters of such an international science.
Thank you. And that exactly is what we have been doing in this symposium and today. A few of the many techniques of the sciences of man have been discussed by us here, along with their possible applications both by the leaders of our nations and the world and by each individual citizen. The important matter on which we can all agree is that there is and can be a community of world scientists who, though with different viewpoints, nevertheless can work together objectively and unemotionally, studying human emotions and their effects on world affairs. Greatly increased public support is needed for these areas of research because they are coping with the questions of primary world importance today. The $2 billion questions. How can we keep man from pushing the buttons that will start the push-button war? How can we assure ourselves of enduring world peace?
Thank you, gentlemen. You have been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss emotions and world problems with L. Vanderhorst, child psychiatrist of Amsterdam, Holland, Robert H. Thawlis, psychologist, Cambridge University, England, Joseph Nutin, psychologist and priest, University of Louvain, Belgium, Gardner Murphy, psychologist of City College of New York, and James G. Miller, chairman of the Department of Psychology of the University of Chicago, as participants. This week's roundtable pamphlet includes the full text of today's discussion and the notable exchange of letters between Professor Albert Einstein and Sigmund Freud on Why War? You'll want to send 10 cents to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to receive this important pamphlet and to find out what Sigmund Freud says about the hopes of mankind for ridding the world of war. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year and receive 52 weekly issues. I'll repeat the address: the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Today's roundtable originated in the Mitchell Tower Studios of the University of Chicago. Alexis de Tocqueville, in 1835, wrote, quote, "The government of the democracy brings the notion of political rights to the level of the humblest citizens. To my mind, this is one of its greatest advantages. I do not say it is easy to teach men how to exercise political rights, but I maintain that, when it is possible, the effects which result from it are highly important." Be sure to vote next Tuesday. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.